Hello, everyone, and welcome to Even If No One Listens, a musical theater podcast. My name is Joe Barsanti.
And I am Brandy Underwood.
So, Brandy, I am very excited.
Why are you excited?
Well, you know, we just ordered a new piece of audio equipment that is going to make our lives so much easier when it comes to recording. We're getting a new audio interface that's going to make it so much simpler to do all the recording, and it's going to make less editing time. The audio quality is going to be better. We're going to sound more balanced to each other, and I am just so excited. So hopefully, knock on wood, we will have that for next episode. And next episode will sound somewhat better, which will be good. So what's the topic today, Brandy?
Today we are talking about our favorite underrated musicals.
We've each picked three underrated musicals, and we're going to kind of talk about them, their history, and why we think they're underrated.
But first, there's a game, Joe, and it's my turn to make the game. I might have gone a little overboard in how difficult this might be.
Okay.
So we'll find out.
You're going to make me look like not smart in musical theater, so this is going to be good.
I don't know. I don't know if this is going to be one way or the other.
Okay, what's the game?
But Joe, ask me what the game title is.
What's the name of the game?
The name of the game is To Which Song Do I Belong?
Okay.
Meaning, I'm going to give you one or a few lines of lyrics that are not necessarily like the main chorus or the hook, and you have to guess the song and the show.
Ooh, okay. Okay.
There's five.
Okay.
So it's not going to be as long as our other shows or our other games.
Well, we'll see how long I take to figure it out.
We shall find out. Are you ready, Joseph?
Yeah.
You don't seem so enthused.
Let's do it.
Okay. So the first one is Emotion, Devotion to Causing a Commotion.
Okay, that's Rent, La Vie Boheme.
Good job.
Emotion, Devotion to Causing a Commotion.
I gave that one, that easy one to you right off the bat. Okay, so
I was going to say, it's like, you know I know Rent, so
yeah. And that's one of my favorite lines, so I had to start off with one of my favorites.
Okay.
The next one. So it's 1 point, Joe. Wherever tension seems to flare, he is the one who's standing there.
Read it one more time.
Wherever tension seems to flare, he is the one who's standing there.
Okay.
Whenever this is one of my favorite songs from a show we have referenced in this podcast.
So I don't know off the top of my head. Wherever tension seems to flare, he's standing there. So some male character. Is this Next to Normal?
No.
Whenever tension seems to flare, he's always... It sounds familiar, but I'm...
So I'm going to give you a hint. It's a very patriotic tune.
Is it Hamilton?
No.
Dogfight?
Nope. Red, White, and True from Big Fish.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so next one. If I don't know about this next one, so let's see. Life is full of contradictions, every inch a mile, and the moment we start weeping, that's when we should smile.
This is Adam's Family.
It is Adam's
it's,
Family.
Hold on, give me a second. Because I did Gomez in college.
That's why I was like, is this one going to trip him up?
Read it one more time and I can tell you what song it's from.
Life is full of contradictions, every inch a mile, and the moment we start weeping, that's when we should smile.
Is that the Wednesday, when were you singing to Wednesday?
Yes, it's Happy Slash Sad.
Happy Sad, yeah. One of the best songs, like probably the most underrated song in that show. Such a good song.
Okay. So, next one. Knowing I had a long, full life in your arms that I can do forever with you.
So, someone's dying.
No, it's not happening.
Well, okay. Read it again.
Knowing I had a long, full life in your arms that I can do forever with you.
I'm not sure. Can I give a hint?
So, it's a song in the last... 5 years. No, what's the
song? Is it last 5 years?
Yeah.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, I gave you the title, so you need to name the title of the song. Which song is it within the last 5 years?
You're not going to repeat the lyrics, are you?
I can.
Can you do it one more time? Because if you...
Knowing I had a long, full life in your arms that I can do forever with you.
Is it called Forever With You?
No.
In your
there
arms?
There is no song called that.
What's the name of the song?
The Next 10 Minutes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That's where Kathy's portion of the song.
Okay. Okay.
See, I told you this might have been hard.
That was tricky. Okay.
See if you get this one too.
Is this the last one?
This is the last one.
Okay.
Words fall through me and always fool me, and I can't react.
Oh, God. What show? I always forget the name of this show. Is this Once?
This is.
Yes, okay.
It's a song title.
I'm having to sing through it in my head. We still got time?
Nope.
What's the name of the song?
Falling Slowly.
Falling Slowly, I said no me. Da, da, ba, da, da.
So, Joe, what did you think of that game?
That was fun.
I feel like I want you to play this game again.
It was a good show. I'd be willing to play that game again.
So, Joe, what is your first on your list for underrated shows?
So, first one on my list of underrated shows is First Date.
She's a little artsy. She's hip and cool.
So, First Date, music and lyrics by Alan Zachary and Michael Weiner, I believe it's pronounced, and book by Austin Weinsberg. I should have learned how to say these names first. So it was on Broadway, ran for about 5 months in 2013, and it's the story of Aaron and Casey, played by Zachary Levi and Krista Rodriguez, respectively, on a blind date, on their first blind date with each other. And during the show, you kind of like get to explore dating expectations, fear of commitment, and learn about the dating histories of both of the people. I picked the show because I've seen it done once or twice locally, but it's such a great show, and it got kind of panned on Broadway, not great reviews, but I think it has some great music to it. It's a very, very funny show, and I don't know. I think this is a show you and I have talked about a lot that we'd love to do one day, but what are your thoughts on First Date?
I think my thoughts on First Date are, like, I love two songs. I don't necessarily hold as much admiration for the show as you do, but I do love the First Impression song. It's the one song that I have kind of repeatedly gone back and watched Zachary Levi and Krista Rodriguez record it. So,
I will give it, because that's a mark of the show. As somebody, that's been a knock of the show. I read a New York Times review that kind of said, like, the music was just mediocre. And there are two songs that are really, really good. First Impressions is really good. And then
Safer, I think, is the one.
Safer is the second one, which is, so it's Krista Rodriguez's character at the end of the show basically saying, I can choose to try and go on another date with this guy and see if it goes somewhere, or I can just continue the safe route of not committing to anybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a good show. It's really funny, and I think it's a really entertaining show. And, you know, I think it should be done more often because it's a cast of, like, I think 5 to 7, really small cast. The pit's not that big. It's not vocally challenging. You know, I think it's a really fun show, and I think it's something that community theaters could do.
Mm-hmm.
So, Brandy, what's your first one?
So my number one underrated musical on my list is Man of La Mancha.
The impossible dream to fight the unknown.
Man of La Mancha was written by Dale Westerman, lyrics by Joe Darn, and music by Mitch Leahy. Hopefully we're pronouncing all those names correctly.
We'll probably be pronouncing a lot of names, and especially when I get to my third one, I'm going to pronounce a lot of names wrong.
So Man of La Mancha is a musical about Cervantes, the writer of Don Quixote way back when, imprisoned and doing a play, kind of a play within a play, so telling the story of Don Quixote while he's in prison as he's writing it, during the Spanish Inquisition. So the story of Don Quixote, just a quick summary of that, is that he's an older gentleman who believes he's a knight errant in going and doing these noble quests. Along the way, he meets this woman named Aldonza and believes that she is his Dulcinea.
Is Dulcinea like a princess?
Yes, she's okay. Like a noble lady. And through the play, we start to see the story of Don Quixote, of like his family trying to rein him in, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end of the show, we see Cervantes finish telling the story of Don Quixote, and then he gets taken off to the Spanish Inquisition. And it's that point in the show where we get the mega hit of that musical.
I am my Don Quixote.
No, that's not the mega hit. You really don't know what the mega hit is?
I'll be honest. Man of La Mancha is a show that I really should learn, but I just haven't listened to.
So the song at the end of the show, which is the more well-known song from that show, is Impossible Dream.
Oh, yeah.
So it's when he's getting carted off to go to the Spanish Inquisition, and everybody who was in the jail that was kind of like acting as characters in this play kind of all rally together and sing that song as he's being sent off to kind of like keep the human spirit within him going.
Well, that's really cool.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. And you know, that, like I said, like that's one of those, I have a list of shows that I haven't seen and haven't researched and haven't really like listened to, you know, like, you know, engaged with. That's one of those shows. Cause I think it's, well, I guess that kind of raises the question. Why do you think it's underrated?
So there's a caveat to this. I think it's underrated now. I don't think it was definitely not okay. Underrated in 1966 mm-hmm. when it came to Broadway. It was like hugely successful, popular. Because
Dreaming the Impossible Dream, that is like that's probably bigger than the show is now, that song by mm-hmm. itself.
Yeah. So I just believe it's underrated that 60 years later, it's still so good and still so timeless.
But we haven't seen like a revival of it.
There was a 2003 revival with Brian Stokes Mitchell as Cervantes/Don Quixote, which he was the original Cole House in Ragtime. Opposite Audra McDonald as Sarah. And so, yeah, that show, that revival really revitalized it and kind of gave new life to especially the song Impossible Dream, because Stokes Mitchell's voice with that song is just so good. The reasons why I believe it's underrated, the heart of the show really comes from Westerman's writing, and it was originally a teleplay years earlier, and
like a play for the TV?
Correct.
That's probably really obvious what that means. I just felt the need to like make sure I knew what that meant.
Yeah. So, and then only till the director that went on to direct the Broadway production, Albert Marr approached him and was like, hey, this would be a great musical. And then it started to get developed. Westerman mm-hmm. even went to a psychic to ask her advice on if he should stick with the show. And she said, and I'm getting this from an article, so mm-hmm. we'll link the article in the show notes in case you're interested in reading it. But she said that yes, it will be extremely successful. In fact, it will overwhelm your life. So I thought that was really interesting because he became a very well-known writer from doing Man of La Mancha.
Were there any other pieces that he's known for, or was it kind of just Man of La Mancha?
No, it was kind of just Man of La Mancha.
But you know what? I don't want to say one-hit wonder, but you know, he...
But it went on to like be a movie in 1972 with Peter O'Toole and Sophia Loren, so like that's a famous movie that probably a lot of people were introduced to this musical.
So it did have a good life. Like he created something that did have a lot of
mm-hmm. and like studying it in school and studying Westerman's path through this and his teachings and his insights on writing, it was really moving for me as a writer in college. So I highly recommend, if anyone's curious further, to just look up videos of him talking about Man of La Mancha.
I actually haven't seen those, so I'll have to look that up too.
Yeah. So, Joe, what's your second one?
So my next one is Bonnie and Clyde.
How about a dance? It's always fun. Come over.
So Bonnie and Clyde, this is one I really love. This is a show that I it's not only underrated, but it's underappreciated, and I think it's such a good show. So music by Frank Wildhorn, lyrics by Don Black, and book by Ivan Menchel. So this show is a story of Bonnie and Clyde. And if you aren't aware, Bonnie and Clyde were an American criminal couple that did a bunch of robberies during the Great Depression. So one thing I really love about this show, to kind of pick on things, is the opening. I think it's one of the coolest opening numbers in a musical I've seen. The show opens up with Bonnie and Clyde sitting in their car dead right after the police shootout that happened. So their end of their spree was a police chase that ended in their car being gunned down, both of them being killed. So the opening of the show is just their bodies sitting in the car while this kind of ragtime piano plays. And then we transition to Bonnie and Clyde as children. And we get to hear young Bonnie dream about being Clara Bow being an actress at the time. And we get to hear young Clyde dreaming about being Billy the Kid. So we get to have this foreshadowing of who they want to be in the future. And it's just such a cool opening number. So the show opened up on December 1st of 2011 and closed on December 30th. So I think it was 33 performances it went through. And then it closed down because of low sales. You know, I did some reading onto the reviews of the show, and I found something kind of interesting. So before it got to Broadway, it played in Sarasota, and it had decent reviews. One review I found here from Wade, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Wade Tantalangefron from BrandonTon.com. We'll link this in the description. Said, quote, Bonnie and Clyde has all the markings of a musical bound for success on the Great White Way and should be mandatory viewing for all local theater enthusiasts. Now, this 1 year later, when it went on Broadway, I have a review from Roma Tor from NY1 said, the show has many virtues, but also enough flaws to keep it from blowing you away. And I think it's interesting, 1 year of difference, and that those are completely different reviews.
Well, that could also be, like, difference in demographics.
It could be demographics. I don't know. You know, because I also tried to see maybe, like, oh, maybe after the Sarasota one, they did a bunch of rewrites, but I couldn't find anything. It seemed like it was the same show. But, you know, it does speak to the critics of different towns and the different tastes of people, but I just think Bonnie and Clyde's such a good show. It's stylistic, so many good tunes from it. The love dynamic between Bonnie and Clyde is so interesting. So, Bram, what are your thoughts on Bonnie and Clyde? Because you saw this a few years back when I played in the pit for it for a production.
Yeah, so it's like one of those that I like the story. I wouldn't go out of my way to see it again, which is why it's on your favorite underrated list. Like, unlike First Date, like, this one didn't have any songs that, like, I liked, and that's probably because they didn't have any songs that I ever sang in vocal lessons when I was in college.
So. You know, I will say, like, unlike, you know, First Date and Man of La Mancha, there isn't really a song from it that like, lived beyond it.
Yeah.
Like, I think there are some really good tunes in it, but, yeah, it definitely...
And I feel like it's almost a, not a necessary thing, but, like, that's what happens with successful shows.
Oh, yeah, every successful show.
Like, they'll have songs that people might know or might be slightly familiar with the song.
But, no, I think you're right with, like, there's lots of times you'll hear a song and, like, oh, that's from a musical? What show is it from?
Mm-hmm.
And no one would ever, you know... listen to When I Drive from Bonnie and Clyde before, like, no one would listen to any of the music from Bonnie and Clyde and, like, oh, it's from a musical? Like, you only know that if you've seen the show.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think it's a super underrated show. And unlike Brandy, I would go see it if I saw somebody doing it local. So, Bram, what's your next one?
So, my second underrated show is Andrew Lippa's The Wild Party.
Don't you wanna be... life of the party, don't you wanna be the cream of the crop?
So yeah, The Wild don't Party, written, music, lyrics, book by Andrew Lippa, premiered April 13th, 2000 off Broadway. And It is a show about lovers Queenie and Burrs decide to throw a party to end all parties in their Manhattan apartment. They have two vaudevillian performers, and after a colorful arrival of slew of guests that live on the edge, Queenie starts to fall in love with one guest named Black, and then there's a love triangle that ensues through the entire show. So that's essentially the synopsis for the show.
So now, wasn't there two shows going on at once, both The Wild Party? If memory serves me right.
So yeah, it's interesting because there were two, around the same time, there were two shows being developed using the same IP.
Same source material.
Same source material, intellectual property. And it was a book by Joseph Moncure March called The Wild Party. So that's the interesting thing, is like, at the same time, there is two shows and using exactly the same characters, same exact
source material, same exact, which it does strike me as like, that's a heck of a coincidence. Like that's a solid coincidence that you wonder, like,
is it a coincidence?
Yeah, is it a I mean, we're not putting any theories out there, but like,
but it's also like, it feels very much like Disney DreamWorks, kind of how the CEO of DreamWorks was once upon a time like a member of Disney's corporation. And
so
then split,
and that's
and
how
then,
you get like Bugs Life and Ants.
Yes.
Very close. Okay.
Kind of similar.
So, I mean, that could be a hypothesis. And it's kind of sad too, because, I mean, this, the Lipa Wild Party was definitely the unsuccessful Wild Party. The other Wild Party was nominated for Best Musical, one year.
Yeah, it was nominated in 2000.
Yeah, so it seems interesting that there definitely is a popular Wild Party and a less popular Wild Party.
What's interesting too is like, Lipa's Wild Party still had was still winning awards and still was getting praise from critics, but for some reason, I don't know if it was like a marketing issue that like, no one saw that one continuing on to Broadway, to have like two of the same shows, same name.
You kind of have to pick one. Like, you're not going to bring both of them on to Broadway at the same time.
Yeah, I don't think that's very fair though, because like, I don't know. It's a complicated, I wouldn't want to be in that situation if I was the writer.
Oh yeah, because no one wins. Because I can imagine if I'm on the side of the one who's on Broadway, it's like, no. Like, as a marketer, I don't want to have to think about distinguishing myself from the other project that has the exact same name and making sure you come to my show and not their show.
Yeah, so it ran with a limited off-Broadway of 52 performances.
Oh, wow.
And then had an encore performance in 2015 with Sutton Foster. So it's been known a little bit to the Broadway community and the people who love musical theater. It's just like one of those diamonds in the rough kind of situations. Mm-hmm. And the kind of refocusing on the like main differences, like, so Lipa's version more or less focuses on the love triangle between Queenie, Black, and Burrs.
And I think it's sad too, because if the show would have come out at any other time, like if they would have been separated, they both probably would have been successful.
So refocusing a little bit on the core differences between Lipa and Michael Lacuza. Lipa focuses on the love triangle between the three main characters, which being Queenie, Black, and Burrs. Also, the tone and the music of the two shows are completely different. Lipa's music is not wholly dependent on the plot of the show.
Yeah, Lipa has a very distinct style, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And from listening to it, it isn't like, Lipa's music isn't set in a time.
Yeah,
like
to where
it's, yeah.
Lachuza's score is more following the plot, but it also like, really directly...
By following the plot, you mean like it's music of the time.
Yeah, correct. To where, not only music of the time, it did relate and use jazz very heavily in
okay,
the show,
yeah.
Where Lipa kind of obscures that
There are some jazzy numbers, but not everything is.
Yeah. Like, the article that I sourced doing my research said, like, Lipa's was more, like, rocky and...
Which is more Lipa's style. It's more that rock.
I think it's, like, almost... The Lipa's Wild Party almost feels like a combination of the two. I don't necessarily see it as being rocky, per se.
But more rocky than the other one,
yeah,
probably.
To where Lipa's is, like, a concept show... And La Chusa's is like the book musical of two.
Interesting.
So yeah, like, and also speaking of examples of songs from Lipa's version that can be taken out of context of the show and still survive on their own, like big songs in the musical that I love are Life of the Party. And like Life of the Party is a big one that's like where it is in the show.
Is Life in the Party, is that the one where they do the juggernaut?
No.
The dance? Okay. Because that's my favorite part of listening to it, is they, like, sing through doing the juggernaut, which is some dance. And it's such a, like, cool, energizing moment.
Yeah, I highly recommend, like, looking up old footage of Lipa's Wild Party, because you see, like, the concept of the costumes and all... A lot of it went into it that was very cool and theatrical.
So what are the big reasons you think that it is underrated?
It's underrated because I believe it's been overshadowed by La Chusa's version based on the same IP.
I think that honestly, like, hearing you speak, this is almost the most... like the truest definition of underrated, that it's like there's a competitor and it got more fame than this one did, but it's still really good. So I think, like, just by definition, I think it probably is one of the more underrated shows on this list.
Another reason I find it underrated is that the original cast had a lot of big time stars before they were ever, like, got their huge
breaking
show. We have Brian D'Arcy James.
He was in Shrek and Something Rotten.
Yeah, and then Taye Diggs.
Rent.
Yeah.
Also did Hedwig, I'm pretty sure.
He's very famous in other television series.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Private Practice and stuff. Julia Murney, who is probably one of the lesser known.
Yeah, I don't recognize that name.
She was in Wicked a little bit. But then, to top it all off, Idina Menzel was in it. And
Wicked,
this is
Rent.
Idina Menzel before 2003. So
that was pre-Rent, or was
this
it post-Rent?
Pre-Wicked.
Pre-Wicked, but post-Rent.
Yeah. So yeah, Joe, what is your third underrated show?
My next underrated show is Chess. So I mentioned earlier about names that are going to be difficult to pronounce. It's going to be this show. So where to start with Chess? So the music was written by ABBA. Music was by Benny Andersson and Bjorn Ulvaeus. I'm probably pronouncing that completely wrong. And then lyrics by Tim Rice and Bjorn Ulvaeus. And then from that, there were actually two different versions. I don't know if you know this. So the original West End version, the book was written by Tim Rice. And then once it came to Broadway, they redid the book. And it was written by Richard Nelson. So, story of Chess. I think, actually, the Wikipedia... I got one sentence from the Wikipedia that I think is a great summary of the show. The story involves a politically driven Cold War-era chess tournament between two grandmasters, one American and the other Soviet Russian, and their fight over a woman who manages one and falls in love with the other.
Ooh.
Like, just really... A nice way to describe the show. So, yeah, the show is all about a chess tournament. And it's a weird concept, but it kind of sort of works. So, the show opened up on April 28th, 1988, and closed on June 25th of the same year. Yeah, so that was about 3 months on. So, speaking to the show a little bit, yeah, so it's the original version, the Broadway version. The music was super synthesizer-y. You know, when you think of, like, when you think of ABBA and that era, you think of that really heavy synthesizer music, and they brought that into the stage show. And, you know, it was, the songs were pretty good. There were a couple tunes that were pretty popular. And I think One Night in Bangkok is probably the song that had the most trajectory afterwards.
Yeah, I remember randomly watching The Hangover 2 and knowing it was set in Bangkok. And I'm like, are they going to reference this song?
Did they?
They did.
Oh, I never saw that. But
it's Mike Tyson singing that song at the end.
I think I'd heard One Night in Bangkok before I heard of this show. And then there are a couple other really good tunes from it. But some, you know, we could talk about the story of the show and all that stuff, but there are some interesting things I found out about this show.
Tell me more.
So the opening night, the first preview. So the first preview they had, okay? First preview was on April 11th, okay?
Okay.
And then their opening night was on April 28th.
Okay.
On April 11th, the show had a runtime of 4 hours.
Oh my goodness.
As well as a 90-minute intermission because there were some technical difficulties. Apparently there was issues getting stuff off the stage, like striking. But regardless, 4 hours for the show. By April 28th, 27 days later, no, 17 days later. So by April 28th, 17 days later, they got the runtime down to 3 hours and 15 minutes.
Oh my goodness.
I just like, I want to be there for that conversation of how you take a 4-hour show and knock 45 minutes off of it.
Yeah.
In 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's a lot of cutting.
Like, it's crazy to think about that. So I mentioned the book writers. So the originally it was done in West End, and the book writer, Tim Rice, you know, there was some decent response from that one. I have.
By the way, Tim Rice wrote the lyrics to Aida and stuff like that too.
I knew Tim Rice sounded familiar. I couldn't place the shows, but while it was in West End, it got pretty good reviews. Like it, I'll say. Mixed. It was mixed to decent reviews.
Hmm.
But then they decided to take it to America. They actually Americanized it a little bit. So what they did was, I don't think they did a big book overhaul, but they rewrote it to kind of like localization, I think is the term.
So was the American in the show always the American with the West End version?
Ooh, I don't know that. I might have to look into that. It could be. The characters are not based off of anyone in particular, but there are kind of like loose people have realized like, oh, it's probably this chess grandmaster and this one.
Mm-hmm.
But that's never been kind of established. So I don't know. I don't think so, judging by what I've read, but I don't know for sure. But yeah, so they Americanized it. And when it came to America and to Broadway, it didn't get any love. It was not. I have 3 reviews.
Yeah, lay them on me.
So I have one from Newsweek here. Newsweek says, Chess assaults the audience with a relentless barrage of scenes and numbers that are muscle-bound with self-importance.
Wow.
Okay, how do you really feel, bud? Like, mm-hmm. Like that's pretty blatant.
1988 was a little bleak for the world.
I have Frank Rich from New York Times wrote, the evening was... Sorry, this one's really funny. The evening has the theatrical consistency of quicksand.
Which isn't as threatening as you might think.
I don't know. That's such a crazy sentence to like dissect what that means. But the night has the theatrical consistency of quicksand. Like, it's just such a cool...
I don't disagree with that, especially the original synthy version. Have you ever, like, anyone just look up Google images of the original show?
Oh, the original. It's interesting. And I'll talk about that in a minute. I have one more review. So this one's from the Chicago Tribune. Richard Christensen. Audiences forgive a lot of failings when they find a show that touches them with its music. And Chess, clumsy and overblown as it sometimes is, in its 3-hour plus running time, gives them that heart. So I think that touches a lot of what Chess is. The music is decent. But I think the story was where it kind of fell apart.
I know that they did a more updated concert version.
They've done a few versions of it. So, the original, like Brandy said, I actually found a picture of it while I was researching this. And they're wearing, some of the chorus are wearing, like,
Don't say chess pieces.
Giant chess pieces.
Oh my
God. They're like not, they're like fabric and look really pretty. Like they're not just like giant pieces, but they're definitely alluding to chess pieces. I think in later ones, they kind of dropped that a little bit. But no, I definitely think the best version of chess is the Chess in Concert.
I agree.
Chess in Concert is from 2009. Among
what a surprise, it does have Idina Menzel in it.
Yeah, Idina Menzel was in it. It also had Adam Pascal, who was in Rent, and Josh Groban, who was in Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. But I think the thing I love most about it, even though the cast was phenomenal and they sang amazingly, they reorchestrated it. So, yeah. Meaning orchestration is the act of taking music and instead of having it for just piano, giving it to lots of different instruments and making it sound pretty in an orchestra or a pit orchestra. So they took this very synthesizer heavy and synthesized sounding show and orchestrated it for the London Symphony Orchestra, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And those songs for orchestra are amazing.
Yeah.
And I honestly think if you would have done chess now, if you were to bring it back, reorchestrate it to kind of like a modern Broadway orchestra, mm-hmm. I think it would do a lot better.
Yeah, I agree. I think the best thing they could have done was getting rid of that synth sound.
It was a lot of synthesizer. And for the time, that was common. You know, like that was the sound of the time, but it did not age well, definitely. Yeah. Like, we have the vinyl for it, and it's...
I don't like listening to it.
It's hard to listen to. Okay, Brian, what is your final underrated musical?
So my final underrated musical is Tick, Tick, Boom.
Why do we play with fire? Why?
Yeah, so Tick, Tick, Boom was written by Jonathan Larson and is more like a biopic musical. Kind of explaining and just showing the story of his life before Rent as a struggling writer.
Yeah, I was going to say, Jonathan Larson being most, probably only known for writing Rent.
Yeah, he's only written these two things. Because he sadly passed away in 1996. Some of my reasons that I think that this is a great underrated musical is because of, if you're a lover of Rent, you need to watch this show because you see the man behind the work in a musical.
And you also hear, like, you can listen to Tick, Tick, Boom and say it, and you can hear, like, the lines from...
There's so many cool, like, moments of the melodies that get referenced in Tick, Tick, Boom that were, like, precursors to songs in Rent.
Oh, yeah. You can definitely hear him playing with ideas in Tick, Tick, Boom that he expounded upon in Rent.
Yeah.
But can you tell the kind of the story of Tick, Tick, Boom? Because you mentioned it's kind of a self-biographic, but what's the story of it?
It's essentially on his 30th birthday. It starts and his girlfriend, longtime girlfriend, wants to move out of the big city and start a family and settle down. His best friend is a wealthy businessman that has a very well-off apartment. And he's struggling with the concept of, do I give up my dream and move out of the city, or do I really double down? I believe in this dream. I'm going to stick it out. So that's kind of the whole concept of the show as he's writing a show and trying to get it produced. And the show that he was trying to get produced at the time was Suburbia. So the show that he was trying to produce at the time was called Suburbia, I believe.
Is that Jonathan Larson or the character?
The character is Jonathan Larson.
Oh, so it, okay. I knew he was referencing his life, but it's a biopic musical. Oh, okay, interesting.
That's the synopsis of the plot.
And, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons this is an underrated show.
Yeah, because, like, it's always a fun thing for me. One of my favorite songs from that show is called Louder Than Words. It's kind of the end, big 11 o'clock number. And sometimes I'll randomly, like, be sitting in a concert listening to, like, choirs or a group sing Broadway songs. And then this song will come up and I'm like, oh, I love this song. Like, I didn't know anyone else knew this song existed. So it's really exciting when you hear that song have life outside the show.
So my favorite song from that show is, I think it's called a therapy song.
It's just called Therapy.
Yeah, Therapy, where I assume it's him and his girlfriend.
Yeah, so it's him and his girlfriend kind of like having this conversation, but they're on totally different pages.
Yeah, it's,
and they kind of lead into an argument, and then it's like, well, it's too late to do what we wanted to do, so let's just go to bed.
Yeah, they're like, they have therapy the next day, and it's just them arguing basically. And mm-hmm. it's such, Jonathan Larson did a great job of musically showing that argument and having them layer over each other, and like, you know, you can't understand what one is saying from the other, but then you suddenly hear them for a second. It's a good song musically, and I think it's a good lesson in songwriting, I think, just seeing how he balanced that.
Another thing that's crazy to think about, he was not only trying to get this Suburbia show produced, he was like noodling around these ideas, like documenting and telling his life struggles of being a writer right now or at the time. And he was able to also then change directions and write Rent. So like he wasn't ever stopping, which is a cool thing to think about and kind of study. It's like you're always writing. Mm-hmm. You're always working.
And that show, did it ever go to Broadway? Because I know there was a version done with Lin-Manuel Miranda.
No, it only was an off-Broadway in 2001.
Really?
Yeah. So
that'd be an interesting one to see eventually go to Broadway.
Yeah, it would be interesting, maybe for like the 25th anniversary of it, yeah, or something like that.
Because I think the music's good and the story's good. And I know people have their opinions of Rent, but I think it's a valid, it's an earlier work for him, but I don't think it's, I don't think it is as good as Rent, but it is very good.
No, like I said before, it's like the precursor of Rent. So it's just really cool. Like, a Broadway nerd is going to love listening to it and watching it because it's like, oh my god, this was something that was in his head that, like, became this song. Mm-hmm. Like, one song, Glory, is, that melody's used a lot in Tick, Tick, Boom and, like, different points. So that's really cool to see how it's, like, wrapped in and still just in his mind. It's like, writers have these melodies that just always keep with them, mm-hmm, and it's like until they can get used
until
the right
you find
time,
the perfect place to use it,
yeah,
you're gonna find other places head to yeah, throw yeah, it yeah in, yeah.
So yeah, those were our top three favorite underrated musicals.
I think there's still probably another list we could go through of more underrated shows, but I think yeah, this is a good selection of like shows that, you know, should have gotten more credit. Probably, maybe, you know, I think in the case of Wild Party should have gotten more credit, or in the case of stuff like Chess, like, just, you know, maybe they shouldn't be done by a community theater, but maybe just give them a listen, because they're interesting pieces in and of themselves.
Do we want to give a quick update on, like, our Oak Island experience?
Sure.
So, yeah, we are trying to take now our 45-minute show that was going to be on a Fringe stage and make it into a 90-minute to a full-length show. And there have been some struggles with that of like,
how do you take a thing that was 45 minutes with a 45 minute plot and make that 90
like
minutes?
I did a lot of cutting and I did a lot of just like, okay, shedding of dead weight.
Yeah, it's
sure
funny
because
we were at a point
minutes
where it was like for the 45 minute that it was too long and we had to cut a lot.
Yeah.
But now we're having to, you know, you have to think about a plot way differently when it's 90 minutes compared to 45 minutes.
Yeah, so yesterday Joe and I had a big brainstorming session. We plotted out the old 45 minute plot and put them on note cards and like so we can see it on the wall. And then we just like came up with these different ideas to like what can we add to make it longer.
Yeah, started pitching different B plots, different things we might have not thought of before.
So we did come up with a loose idea of what the 90 minute plot is. While keeping a lot of what we wrote and a lot of good stuff that we had, because like we've mentioned, this has been a 2-year in the works musical and I'm not ready to just throw everything away.
Yeah, and I think because of that time to that moment to sit down and just kind of look at everything where it is, and especially visualizing it on the wall, was really helpful to get a sense of, okay, where are we? And I think the thing that helped me the most, even though I'm just doing lyrics and music, kind of when we looked at the show as a three act structure and kind of seeing like, okay, where are our like metaphorical three acts and what's happening for each one, that really helped me kind of understand the momentum of the show and the weight of moments, and also kind of showed us, you know, where do we need other things happening? Where do we need B plots happening? Where do we need, you know, other motivations coming through?
Yeah, because like with turning it into a 90 minute, it's following much more of those regimented structures of like, here's the I want section. Here's how we get, if we put an intermission, which we're still not sure if we're going to need to. Here's where like the song after the intermission kind of reintroduces us into the world. So we needed to know those major points and like come up with scenes that explain that or allow us to explore that. So I highly recommend, if you have a huge wall, like eventually we're going to dry erase paint that wall, and that way we can just write on it. We're always thinking of creative ways of turning our home into more effective writing areas.
But yeah, I think that is a good point of just being able to kind of visually see things for a moment, you know, to be able to step back and look at things on a bigger scale and just say, okay, here's the timeline of all my plot points and let's see how it looks. And then from there, you can start analyzing, okay, what, you know, where would I think my act one ends, my act two ends, where would I put an intermission? And I think there's a lot of benefit to that. And I think it is something that people should try doing for writing, for when you have issues in writing.
I highly recommend writers like doing that with your whole writing team.
I think you need to. I think you need everyone's voice. Because I mean, I pitched a couple plot points and B plots that I think we might end up using. And even though I'm not writing the book, I'm still vested in it.
Through,
I think it's important.
Some debate and arguing, yes, that was.
But
that
I think, you know, it's important to say, like, we both care about the project and we have passionate opinions about what we think works and doesn't. So I think from those debates, I think we have some pretty cool ideas, but I think we need to flesh them out and see how they work, how they feel. Well, everyone, thank you very much for listening to episode 6 of Even If No One Listens, a musical theater podcast. My name has been Joe Barsanti.
And my name is always Brandy Underwood.
And we will see you next week.